I would like to ask you to take out your Bibles and turn along with me to the book of 2 Samuel and chapter 2. 2 Samuel chapter 2, we'll be reading there together in just a few moments. I want to begin by welcoming all of those who are here with us this morning. And also apologize to those who are joining us on the stream. I forgot to hit the microphone on at the start of the service. Yesterday, I turned a year older, and as many of you kindly reminded me, these are the sorts of things that start to happen as you turn years older. And so I had a premature senior moment, and I apologize to those joining us at home for that. But I think we're all together now, and as we said, we'll be looking together at 2 Samuel chapter 2. It's a great grace to get to be here together with each of you this morning, with our church family, for those of you who are visiting with us. Our services are a good bit different from our norm, but I hope that they are encouraging to you nonetheless. The bulk of our lesson this morning is going to be coming from the Old Testament character of Joab. Now, many of you are familiar with Joab, and you remember him as the commander of the king's armies, as someone who was central to the life of King David. And you'll remember that although he was a mighty man in terms of stature and valor, we do not remember him as being among David's mighty men. Those people who fought with courage and dignity and honor. Instead, we remember him as being a difficult and a violent man. Joab was someone who had to be dealt with. And I think that to understand and appreciate the character of Joab, we have to understand that he was, to some degree, a product of his time. David's reign over Israel, while prosperous in many senses of the word, it was still a time in Israel's history where it was punctuated by disunity, by disruptions of peace. And it is within that context that we're initially introduced to Joab. In fact, it's usually within that type of context that Joab will make an appearance at all. He first comes onto the scene earlier in 1 Samuel chapter 26 and verse 6 when his other brother Abishai is encouraging David to act out against King Saul. But Joab really comes into his own in 2 Samuel chapter 2. And it's there that our discussion is going to begin this morning. So if you're not already there, be turning. I want to give you a little bit of context as you turn to 2 Samuel chapter 2. At this point in the narrative, the previous King Saul has fallen in battle. But the tribes of Israel have not yet united behind King David as a whole. It is a time in the nation of God's people where they are divided, and the situation is extremely tense, to say the least. And so it's under these kinds of circumstances that you have Abner, who was the leader of the pro-Saul forces, meeting up with Joab, the leader of the pro-David forces at the pool of Gibeon. And what starts out in verse 14 as, you know, ostensibly just a wrestling match between the two sides to let off some steam and tension leads to 24 casualties and an all-out battle breaking out. Now, David's forces very quickly gain the upper hand, and it becomes apparent that they are the ones who are going to win, and so Abner begins to flee. But along the way, he's followed by yet another brother of Joab named Asahel. And every step of the way, Asahel is keeping pace. And in 2 Samuel chapter 2, beginning in verse 18, we read, "Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Asahel. And Asahel was as swift-footed as one of the gazelles which is in the field. Asahel pursued Abner and did not turn to the right or to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, 'Is that you, Asahel?' And he answered, 'It is I.' So Abner said to him, 'Turn to your right or to your left and take hold of one of the young men for yourself and take for yourself his spoil.' But Asahel was not willing to turn aside from following him. Abner repeated again to Asahel, Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab? However, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of the spear so that the spear came out his back, and he fell there and died on the spot. Now, I think that it is apparent in the text that if Abner had been able to choose, he would have rather not taken the life of this man, Asahel. He knew that in a time of great division, doing so would have only caused further division. It would have made the situation worse in every way. And it certainly would have caused a great divide between himself and Joab. But Asahel was determined to follow in spite of the warnings that were given to him, and he paid with his life. Now in the following chapter, Abner has a falling out with the house of David, or with the house of Saul rather, and he determines that it's time to make peace with David. And there are conditions that are laid out to make that peace by David, but by and large, David is eager to accept the proposition for peace. We read in 2 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 20, "Then Abner and 20 men with him came to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. Abner said to David, 'Let me arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may be king over all your soul desires.' So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace." And so I imagine that, those who were gathered together for that feast assumed that all was well, that the two sides from this have come together and there's going to be peace, and peace seems to have been made, except that not everybody had begun to move on. Chief among them, Joab. And after learning from the king's men that Abner, this former enemy, had come and gone, Joab learns of his whereabouts and he begins to take action of his own. And again in chapter 3 in verse 26, when Joab came out from David, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it. So when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the middle of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him in the belly so that he died on account of the blood of Asahel, his brother." Now I think that there are certain aspects of Joab's character that are revealed by this account. But for now, what I want you to see from the narrative so far is that this was an occasion where David and others tried to make peace, but they did so without regard for whether or not the underlying issues had truly been resolved. And because of this, it collapsed in the most spectacular fashion. Now, unfortunately for David, unfortunately for everyone, this would not be the last cause for this type of division in Israel. And it would not be the last instance involving Joab either. If you would, please be turning to 2 Samuel chapter 14. We're going to move forward in the narrative just a little bit. We're going to deal with the attempts from David to make peace and reconcile with his wayward son Absalom. Many of you will recall that sometime later on in David's reign, the king's son Absalom had been banished for taking the life of his half-brother Amnon. And after some time, Joab actually gets involved and he convinces the king to bring Absalom back. And yet when he brings him back, he's not really restored. We read in the text that he stays in Jerusalem for a couple of years without ever actually seeing his father David. Now, as you can imagine, that doesn't really feel like reconciliation. And so after a little bit of time, he reasons to himself, "Well, if Joab was able to help me out this far, maybe he'll be able to help me out some more." And so he sends a message to Joab, "I want to see the king," or "I want to speak to you." And Joab doesn't answer. Well, he sends out a second message. And Joab still doesn't answer. And so in 2 Samuel chapter 14, beginning in verse 28, well, we can drop down to verse 30. Therefore, he says to his servants, "See, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose, came to Absalom at his house, and said to him, "Why have your servants set my field on fire?" Absalom answered Joab, "Behold, I sent for you, saying, 'Come here, that I may send you to the king, to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me still to be there. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face, and if there is iniquity in me, let him put me to death.'" So when Joab came to the king and told him, he called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. Now let's pause there in the text. You know, incidentally, I'm not one for trying to dramatize the textual reading. I don't feel like I quite did Joab justice in wondering why he got his field set on fire there. But that's one way to get someone's attention. So Joab comes, and why have you done this? And, well, it's the only way that I could get you to answer me. This is not a way to build relationships. Now, we're going to summarize some of the events that follow, but it's important for now for you to tuck this occasion in the back of your mind. And so Absalom has been restored, but again, there are a host of underlying issues that have not yet been resolved. Now, on the top of that are the issues with Absalom himself. And you'll recall that in the months that follow, Absalom enacts a plan to steal away the loyalty from Israel. And you'll recall that at first his plan is successful. David is driven out of Jerusalem as people begin to side with his son. Many key figures in his cabinet defect to the other side. And Absalom was almost victorious. But slowly the tide begins to turn against Absalom. And the time comes for a decisive battle to win back the kingdom for David. And David, wishing to spare Absalom's life, if at all possible, gives explicit instructions in chapter 18 and verse 5 for Joab and the others to do him no harm. Our theme is continued. Again, overtures are being made for peace, but the underlying issues are far from resolved. Now, when the battle commences, the forces of Absalom are very quickly routed. And once again, we find the enemy trying to flee. And Absalom, as you recall, in his haste to get away, becomes entangled in the branches of an oak tree. When the report came to Joab, this is how the conversation unfolded. In 2 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 10, "When a certain man saw it, he told Joab and said, 'Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak.' Then Joab said to the man who had told him, 'Now behold, you saw him. Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? And I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt.' The man said to Joab, 'Even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, "Protect for me the young man Absalom. Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof.' Then Joab said, 'I will not waste time here with you.' So he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him." Now, I think that from a certain point of view, there's a certain amount of practicality that can be read into Joab's action. Absalom, in the eyes of many, could not be permitted to live. He had committed a treasonous crime. He had led opposing armies, caused the death of many Israelites in doing so. And he probably would have been a continual thorn in the side of David if he had been allowed to live. But I don't think that we can attribute the actions in this verse to Joab just being such an altruistic person. I think that the man in verse 13 probably has the right of it. Joab wanted Absalom dead for personal reasons. And if someone else could have done his dirty work for him, then all the better. And he says, I know what would have happened. If I had done this when the king found out about it, you would have thrown me under the bus. I don't care how much you offer me. I would point to the brutality of the murder in verses 14 and 15 to underscore that point. But once again, for now, this is what I want you to carry away from this portion of the text. For a second time in David's reign, he has tried to force peace on people without addressing their underlying conflicts. And for a second time, it has ended in terrible violence. I want to look at another incident, one more incident, before we begin to make some specific applications this morning. This one in the timeline really follows immediately on the events of this in the text. But we need to take a step back and establish a little bit of context very briefly. Earlier on, when Absalom took the reins of power, one of the first things that he did was to change out the officials from the previous regime and replace them with those that he thought would be more loyal to him. And that included, incidentally, replacing Joab as the commander of Israel's armies. Now, he replaces him with a man named Amasa. We read about it in 2 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 25 very briefly. I think we can imagine that having somebody take your former job would be insulting in its own right. And yet we read in that verse in chapter 17 that Amasa was actually a relative of Joab's. And if I understand the text correctly, it would seem to hint that this is a relative who was not born under the most honorable of circumstances. And so, in addition to just the tense nature of having someone replace you, there is a bit of familial rivalry that is taking place in this story as well. And so while the situation was already tense, again, to say the least, this just heightens that tense nature of the encounter. And so back to David's victory following the death of Absalom. Once again, David, and understandably so, is eager to get peace. Let's put this behind us, a quick resolution to the conflict. And so in chapter 19 and verse 12, starting, David extends an olive branch to the elders of the cities who had rebelled against him. And in doing so, he also sees an opportunity to maybe finally get rid of this troublesome element in Joab. And so speaking to Amasa, the person who had replaced Joab for Absalom, David sends this message. Are you not my bone and my flesh? Chapter 19, verse 13. Are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me and more also if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab. Well, as one writer puts it, Joab doesn't brook rivals, and so Amasa's tenure was brief. We turn just a page over, and in chapter 20 and verse 8, when they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was dressed in his military attire, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened at his waist, and as he went forward, it came out. Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand, so he struck him in the belly. We'll pause there. This is the picture that I'm wanting you to see. The theme that we are connecting in each of these incidents in the life of David and the life of Joab. David's reign was punctuated by periods of peace, but also by periods of great tension, of division among God's people. And oftentimes Israel seemed as though they had moved beyond these encounters, and yet they seldom did so very well, because core issues were left unresolved, and there were many who were satisfied to take comfort in a very surface level reconciliation. But the problem with that is that whenever a potential for conflict arose, it usually did. Now, Joab provides for us an example of that on an individual level. While others assumed that peace had been accomplished, his unresolved bitterness and resentment just waited for those opportunities to break forth. And what Joab illustrates so well is that you cannot have real peace without allowing wounds to properly heal. Now, our congregation, like many congregations, in fact, let me just change that to most, if not all, has had its own share of tension. It's worked through tension in the past. And because we are a congregation made up of people, we know that there will be tension in the future. Again, we're not alone in that fact. But whenever tensions arise, we need to understand that there is a danger in moving on without making sure that wounds have been healed, and without understanding that wounds take time to heal. There is a danger in me assuming a very fragile, a very brittle, surface-level peace where, again, those underlying issues may be left resolved. It is important that we understand that all of the principles that we looked at last week and we agreed were so important are principles that must be consistently practiced over time. Reconciliation in its truest sense is only accomplished when people are committed to working on relationships for a sustained period. My determination to move past any issue has to be paired with a determination to fully dedicate myself to addressing an issue. It's only then that I can fully accomplish healing with grace and with completion. Now, I don't pretend to know how in any given conflict any number of individuals may be affected. But I think that in any given disruption to peace, many people will be affected, and they will be affected differently. But I do think that there are some common areas that tend to go unresolved following conflict. And what I want us to do in this final portion of our lesson is to briefly consider three attitudes that I think must be checked following any occasion of conflict. It begins by asking myself, after conflict, what is my attitude toward my brethren? Very specifically, here's what I mean by that. We cannot afford to carry baggage with us from one conflict to the next. I have to be careful about allowing prior conflict to shape the way that I see other people. I cannot walk away from conflicts thinking of brethren of, well, I remember how this person acted last time. I can't walk away from conflict thinking this is how I expect these people to act this time. It poisons my perspective, and it lowers the view that I have of others. I have to be careful that following any given conflict, that I give as much grace as is possible toward the actions of others. To remember that in whatever measure I judge, that is how I will be judged when it is my turn. I have to remember that whatever my concerns or griefs with others may be, I only have two options. I either have to address those things directly, or I have to come to a determination that whatever my concern may have been, perhaps it is something that I can let go. But those are the two options. Walking away from conflict and having unresolved feelings and attitudes toward other brethren, that is not on the table. And then I have to ask myself, do I have a right view of my leaders? Folks, we have to understand that elders do not have a magical power where they can stop the flow of time. Elders have to respond to life events as they unfold, doing so knowing that they have an enormous responsibility before them. They react the best they can with the resources that they have to the situations that have been placed before them. And we all have to be careful that we do not fall into the trap of looking at leaders during or following conflict and thinking, well, I would have done it differently. For one thing, you need to be careful because next time they may let you handle it. I would have done it differently. Well, maybe you would have. That's great. Do you think that elders can improve, that they can do better? Guess what? You're not thinking anything that they haven't thought. They're the first ones who want to grow, who want to improve. And so you need to walk away from any conflict, making sure that you do not have unresolved feelings towards your leaders and the way that they, to the best of their ability, have handled their God-given responsibilities. Because if you carry those things with you into the future, it will warp your perspective beyond reality. And nothing that anyone does will be enough. I have to ask myself, following conflicts, what is my attitude of the Lord's church? In any congregation, it is easy to keep a running tally of conflicts, of problems, of any situation that I may be dissatisfied with, whether it's great or small. And over time, I can become disillusioned and I allow these things to pile up and I'm discouraged and I think that somehow the church is not all it's cracked up to be, because look at all of these things that have happened over the last 5 or 10 or 20 years. Over time, an image is constructed in my mind that does not match what the church actually is. The mistakes, the missteps of a few or many individuals cannot change the nature of the church that Jesus built and that Jesus purchased. The church cannot be stained or tarnished. It is immortal and beyond the reach of the mistakes that we may make as people. Now, having said that, again, the church is made up of people. And that means that on a local level, there will be problems from time to time. But brethren, we need to see and we need to appreciate that the growth and the maturity that comes from brethren working through their issues only enhances the beauty of the church. It does not take away from it. It cannot take away from it. And so as we work through and we walk away from conflicts and pursue peace, We have to make sure that what we are pursuing is real peace, where underlying conflicts are resolved on every individual level. Understanding that we cannot have peace when we do not allow for wounds to properly heal and to be addressed. And to that end, we have to make sure that we resolve. We resolve, we resolve, we resolve wherever the problem may be. That we do not have a peace that consists of walking on eggshells around each other lest we say the wrong thing and accidentally bring up the ghost of a memory of something that may get someone addled. Resolve your issues with your brethren. Work together to achieve real peace with grace and completion. As we draw to a close this morning, again, we would be remiss not to call our minds and attention to the greatest act of reconciliation, the one that sets the pattern for us, the sending of God's Son to reconcile sinners unto Himself, and to remind each one present that the opportunity is always yours, and that if the desire is there to obey the gospel, let your brethren know, let the elders, deacons, anyone know, an opportunity will be made. And for the rest of us, if we need prayers, your brethren are here for you. Let's make sure that we're offering for those prayers each and every day. I ask for you to take just a moment as we transition to the next portion of our worship service, and our brother will take a moment to lead us in a few songs.